Conestoga Podcast, Program 28 for Tuesday, June 19th, 2007. I'm your host, Chris Murley, and I'd like to welcome our listeners back for the final podcast recorded at Conestoga 10. This one is a double feature. I have the pleasure of bringing you an extremely talented duo, our artist guest of honor, Don Mates, and his wife, the equally talented author and artist, Janie Wirtz. I interviewed each of them separately, so first up is Janie Wirtz. Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Chris Marley, your podcast host, and I'm interviewing Janie Wirtz, an artist and a writer, and I'm also interviewing our artist guest of honor, Don Mates. And thank you for joining me today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having us.
Likewise for me. It's great to be here.
Okay. I think what we're going to do is, since both of your works are so very different, I think we'll go ahead and start with Janie and talk to you first, and then when we're done, we'll go ahead and talk to Don. Is that okay?
That's fine by me.
Okay. Well, of course, earlier today, Janie was on a panel with us on podcasting. What is podcasting? Hopefully, we gave our audience an idea of what was at least where to start with getting podcast to start doing a podcast, whether you're a fan or an author or whatever. One of the questions I asked you, because I told you earlier today that I had interviewed Steve Pagel, and he said that you were in the publishing industry, and you said you wouldn't quite go that far. But the story that you told me was very fascinating because you work very hard to get where you are today, and that to become a success, an overnight success, you have to work for a lot of years doing various things. And did you want to go and tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, I ran on the theory that if I graduated from college and I had the aspiration to write my own books and publish the covers and make it into the major publishing market as an author legitimately and an illustrator legitimately, that I couldn't necessarily start at the top. I had to start somewhere, and I realized that if I took a regular day job, it would be a trap. I would come home too tired to create anything, and I would not be able to take the drop in income that you would have to do. So what I did was I took part-time jobs, and I started out in the very basement of the industry at the time, which would have been pasting up for a quick printer. I actually worked hourly at a Sir Speedy instant printer in the back room, laying out the type and pasting it up. I progressed from there to doing graphic design freelance, even up to calligraphy and addressing wedding invitations, whatever would get me a paycheck that was even close to art or type related. And then I went into illustrating for war games. So Mayfair Books, War Games, I did a lot of their cover work. And then I went into the cover market when the work was really ready. So this enabled me to learn on the job. And in the background, I was writing novels. So just about the time I sold my first chance to illustrate somebody else's book to a New York publisher, I also sold my first novel.
Excellent. Yes, you are a very envious position because a lot of authors don't necessarily get to do their own covers, and you do. And how do you – do you obviously, that is a little different than illustrating someone else's. Do you have in mind exactly what you want to do for the cover when you illustrate your own books?
In general, yes. I know a year in advance anyway what the image is going to be.
And is it something that might necessarily, hopefully it won't give away what's in the, you know, be a plot spoiler on the cover?
Well, the best images always make you want to read the book.
Yes.
So you're trying to set the mystery. The what if question has got to be on that cover. You never want to give away the plot.
Yeah. That's probably a question I'll have to ask Don later, if that's a danger that, you know, the illustration that he comes up with for a book cover that might, that even though that's what he think might work best, you have to try to avoid, like, giving it away, but you want them to read to want them to buy that book.
You want to entice them in
Yes.
some way. You need to pick a moment that leads to another moment that isn't shown. So the person looking at it goes, what's about to happen? I've got to find out. If you're curious, you can go to my website and see sequentials of covers being painted or see how they go together, and you can see all the book covers that I've done, and you can see whether I did a good job. If you read the book and you say, well, you gave away the ending, I don't think I have yet. I haven't gotten any angry fan mail. But
well, That's good.
Don't take what I say. Go look at what I do.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the website I get was JannieWurts.com. Is that correct?
That will get you there, yes.
Yeah, and that's W-U-R-T-S. There's no Z. Unfortunately, I've written down your name wrong a few times because writing on Don Mates, you know, with a Z. It's,
yeah, JannieWurts, JannyWurts.com.org. It'll all get there.
And you can see some amazing illustrations when you go look at that website. And one of the things I didn't write down, which I should have, was what is your most recent book that you've come out with?
The most recent is Traitor's Knot. If you're a new reader, though, you'll want to go to the second most recent, which is called To Ride Hell's Chasm, available from Misha Merlin, because that one stands alone. It has no sequels and prequels. It's not part of a series. So the whole plot takes place in 5.5 days.
In 5.5 days. Is there a little bit that you can tell us about the book without giving away the plot, you know, make them want to read from?
Well, it's about, it begins as a mystery. It goes right into a court intrigue rather smartly, and it ends up as a very hardcore action adventure. And it's really about the ethics of the warrior, but the plot is that the princess doesn't show up for her betrothal banquet. And so it begins as a mystery. Why didn't she show up?
And then they have to go find her.
In the course of searching to find her, you find out that there really is a threat to the kingdom. I have a first chapter in excerpt on the web, so you can go read the first chapter right on my website.
I do believe there are a fair number of excerpts from your works on the web, including an audio chapter as well.
There are, and there's an MP3 available as a download, and that would be chapter 11 from Fugitive Prince. It's just a little quick excerpt. So that'll give you a taste if you want to just listen to the audio and not bother to read. There is an audio chapter.
Are there any books that we can look forward to that are coming out soon, or are you working on anything in particular?
I'm just finishing up Stormed Fortress, which is the next one in my big series. Okay. And there's some 5 or so short stories available right now in various anthologies that are either issued now and available or about to come out. Probably one of the more significant ones was for Elemental, which all of the proceeds go to Tsunami Relief Save the Children's Fund. All of the authors participating in that anthology and the publisher are sending their profits, so we are not making a penny. It's all for the relief effort.
And it's interesting that we have two other authors at this convention that also have a story in it. Martha Wells and David Drake also have a story in that as well, and I will be hitting you up for your autograph later.
Okay, that's a deal.
Now, one of the things, I guess, for people that are interested in writing and they get a book sold, from the time that it's, you know, that they get it sold, and a lot of people don't necessarily know how long the process takes, not of actually writing the book, but for the time you send it to the publisher and they're ready to say, okay, we're going to buy it. What are some of the steps involved, and rather, from the time they say, we're going to buy it, to the time that it hits the store shelves, whether it's a hardcover or mass market or trade paper, does it depend on the publisher, or how long does that process usually take for you?
Well, it really does, and it depends if you're a new author or an old hand, and it changes from year to year depending on conditions in the marketplace. If you're a new author right now, I have heard the submission time for some of the major publishers is 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
You may have to wait that long just to get a response back. So in today's conditions, definitely be patient. If you're an author who's been in print and you resell a new book, it may take 2 or 3 years to put it in schedule because they'll have bought have scheduled their next 2 years' worth of books. If they buy you as a contract, then they're going to give you a turn-in date, and if you make the turn-in date, they're probably going to have an idea of when you're going to appear in schedule. But if you miss your turn-in date, then that could put the novel off. So usually, if I turn in a book, it's going to come out within a year. Production's going to take about 8 to 9 months, and that's pretty standard. So if I finish a book and turn it in, usually it cannot possibly come out sooner than that unless they put a rush on it. And since that costs money, they're not going to do that unless they have to.
So maybe some advice for a new writer that they sell their first book and it could be 4 to 5 years before it actually sees print. Would you recommend that they just go ahead and keep on writing and just keep sending stuff out rather than waiting on pins and needles to find out what's going to happen to their book?
You have to. You have to. You cannot stop and wait the 4 years while your one novel's in submission, because the trick is, the minute you get bought, if your stuff is any good, they're going to look at what else you're doing. If your first book is really good and they buy it and you have a second and a third ready, they may buy all three. In the case of Lois Bujold, who's a very well-known author, she sold up 4 books as her first sale, and they put them out every 6 months for 2 years. And immediately she shot up because people could find her stuff. So don't wait. And if you finish a novel and it's going to take maybe 8, 9 months or a year in production till it comes out, you better be writing another novel, because otherwise you're going to have a 2-day or a 2-year delay on your books on the shelf. And what you may not realize is the bookstore computers only go back 2 years. If you don't issue a title every 2 years, then your history will be forgotten. So you need to keep producing. If you're serious about your craft, you don't ever stop producing. And you never know when a publisher merges or something changes. You know, your situation can change on a dime. And so if you're producing, you're always prepared.
Now, to flip the other side of the coin, you can probably also answer this question as well. It has to do with illustration for covers and so forth. I assume the process is a little different for people that are starting out illustrating and painting to get their works into print, either necessarily, even all the way, you know, illustrations in magazines and even to end up doing book covers. Is that a significantly different process for artists that are wanting to eventually be able to do book covers for well-known writers?
Well, is it different? If you're the writer, you're closer to being the primary creator.
Mm-hmm.
Your idea is what the publisher buys. The illustrator, in this case, is going to be the secondary creator because they're going to be drawing an image from that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And how that progresses through the publishing house changes according to house and house and house. Right now, many people are going to have a say as what that image is going to be. It's no longer, we'll hand you a manuscript, as the artist, you send us an image anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most often the publishing house has an idea of where they want to market that. So if you want to break in as an illustrator, first of all, draw what you want to draw.
Okay.
Figure out what you love to do. Figure out where in the marketplace other things like that are being done, and that's where you will submit your portfolio. And what becomes of the production of those illustrations will depend very much on how that branch of publication works. But you got to start out with what do you love and make your portfolio around mm-hmm. that. That's step one.
Okay. Well, those are some excellent answers, and hopefully people will take that to heart when they're starting out. It's amazing because what I've learned about you, you're very talented. Not only you're an artist, you're an author, you're also a musician. And I understand you're also a champion bagpiper. Is that correct?
Well, I've done a little bit of that, yes. I would hand the good fortune to, I had a phenomenal teacher. Mm-hmm. And if you practiced really hard under that teacher, you almost couldn't miss. But it did take a lot of years of dedication and work to come up to that standard.
I'm going to go back up a little bit here because we want to talk about your art a little bit and what informs it and what inspires it. You have a lot of life experiences that really influence or inspire your art. And how does that play into what you create?
Well, and were you thinking painting or writing or both?
Whichever one inspires you the most.
Well, it goes both ways. So
okay.
I'll give you an example of both ways.
Okay.
In the case of the book I was mentioning earlier, To Ride Hell's Chasm, there is a race that's run every year for endurance for horses, where these people get these horses incredibly fit, and they do 100 miles over some of the worst terrain in the country. It's a desert, up and down mountains. It's called the Tevis Cup. And they do this race in under 24 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
And I thought this sounded like such a stupendous feat. And you see what these horses go through, and you see what the riders go through, and they love their animals. I mean, the partnership that's exhibited in this competition. Well, I did a lot of show riding and a lot of riding of 3-day event and getting horses very, very fit, but nothing like this. So I thought, what would happen if you were in a kingdom where the terrain was very, very rugged and you had to get out by a route that was considered impossible? And what if you had a bunch of horses? So the horses, there are 5 horses in Hell's Chasm that are very much every bit as important as the hero and the heroine. And without those horses, they could not have succeeded. And so I strove to capture my experience working with horses, and it went right into the book. That's not the main theme of the book by any means, but I have had people come up and say, I can never look at a horse the same way, even my imagination. After reading your book, I realized what it's like to work up close and personal with an animal that's like that. So there's an example of a life experience falling right into a book. In the case of artwork, I used to open houses on Nantucket to pick up odd money. You know, I'd go up there pre-season and work like crazy and strip the paint and clean out the dead cheese out of the fridge from last year in exchange for a cottage. And I could stay in the cottage until it was rented. So I got to spend lovely pre-season time on Nantucket Island. And one day this really nasty storm came in over the water. It was just unbelievable, this wall of black cloud. And I took some photographs of it. And I wound up putting it in a painting with a picture of a wizard. And the wizard had a hawk in his hand because my landlord did falconry right in the backyard. So I lived 13 years with this guy manning birds right in the backyard, much like your royal gauntlet earlier today, only it was right there outside my window. So I painted a picture of this wizard with a goshawk, which was one of my landlord's birds. And I put the storm coming in over Nantucket Island in the background. And about halfway through the painting, I said, who is this guy? What's he doing in this picture? And out of that, I realized, well, this wizard is a weather wizard, and this bird is the seed of the storm that he's sending somewhere else.
Okay.
And out of that, I got my cycle of fire, which begins with Storm Warden. And if you look, there's the picture of the wizard and and the hawk. And so there is a case of an image creating an entire three novels, all cobbled together out of little bits of life experience that happened all around. So, yeah, I've delved into offshore sailing. I've traveled into strange wilderness places. All of those things have found their way into the stories. Done mountaineering.
Mountaineering.
It all shows. Yeah, Master White Storm has areas where I've used everything. There's nothing like feeling like you've been there.
Yeah. Well, you're almost one writer that I'm reminded of that who has gone out and done a lot of courses, you know, everyone hears of Ernest Hemingway, you know, he went and did a lot of things, and so, and I don't know how well that helped him, but...
Well, it gives your stories a sense of gritty realism. I mean, there's nothing worse than a writer that sits there and says, well, I know what it's like to do that. I'll just sit down and sit in my chair and pontificate and make it up.
Yeah.
Here's an example. Well, I was at a writing workshop. This is fun.
Okay.
And there was someone there that wrote about being caught in a calm in a sailboat. And they described the pervasive sense of silence driving everybody crazy. And I said, ah, you got it completely wrong. If you've ever been becalmed in the middle of the ocean on a sailboat, the last thing you have is silence because there's a residual swell. There's no wind pushing on that boat to keep the gear still. So that boat rolls, and every single block, every single piece of tackle, every single loose thing in the galley goes bang, rattle, clang, slap. The first thing that you do is go crazy because of the noise. There is no escape.
And I think that's important because I've seen a lot of fantasy. I've heard fantasy stories where they're regurgitating what they've read rather than using the experiences that they've had to inform what they've written.
Yeah, well, I told this author, no. You're going to knife somebody because of the noise. And if you write that, it's a whole lot more effective than it was so peaceful. Being becalmed is not peaceful.
Well, I think that would be an interesting, that would certainly make a more interesting story if one of the other persons knifed someone, then because that certainly brings an element of tension into the tale. I find this fascinating, and I'm kind of at a loss for words to what to ask you next, but you're getting involved in many, many things, and are you looking – I think you mentioned earlier when we were talking about podcasting is that you're more interested in doing – I got the impression that you're more interested in like maybe audiobooks, the traditional ones where or entertainment that people can purchase on a CD or download for purchase rather than necessarily the
I wanted to create sample chapters.
Oh, sample chapters.
And then I wanted to create sample – short stories from back history of major series to both clarify major series and also so people could enjoy and say, well, would I want to invest in seven books? Because some of my series go for a bit. Well, if they have a podcast type story, you know, if they can hear the MP3 file. And also I do music. So I thought, what a great place to put some of the music that's inferred in the books as available as an MP3, but I got to make it, so I've got to master the technology, the learning curve, and so on.
Well, I think you'll make it there. So what you're doing then, in fact, is you're doing what a lot of people are doing, is using the podcasting technology as one more promotional tool for your art.
That, and also I think that there's room for helping people coming into the field get educated quickly enough as to how this industry works. So many new authors and artists coming in, they're wet behind the ears, and they make mistakes that have been made and made and made, and they're unnecessary mistakes. If they understood how the industry worked, then they could save a lot of steps and save themselves some heartache. So I see podcasting as a way that new writers and new artists can talk to older hands and not have to repeat inventing the wheel every generation.
Well, Janie, I want to thank you. And there's one little thing we just want to bring up real quick. I did notice that you have a reward on your website. An unfortunate incident happened a couple of years ago. There were some paintings that had were lost or stolen. And I certainly want to do my part in publicizing that we want those paintings recovered for them. And what did you say the reward was?
$5,000 reward. Just in a nutshell, Don and I lost something like 30 paintings in a shipment going to a convention. It disappeared off a Federal Express truck, and the paintings have not been found. There's full information on my website or Don's. Simply go to the stolen art page, and you can see all of those images. And we would love to have a lead and find those, and we'd be happy to see that reward get placed.
Well, I certainly hope that making people aware will at least get people thinking about it again.
Our fans are everywhere. These
paintings
cannot be hidden for our entire lifetime. I'm sure they'll show up.
Well, I certainly hope it'll happen sooner rather than later.
Oh, me too.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Janie. I think I'm going to go ahead and talk to Don now.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome. As you can tell, Janie is a very accomplished artist and author, so be sure to check out her website, paravia.com. That's paravia.com for more about her novels and her artwork. And next, I turn the microphone to Don Mates. Now we're continuing the interview with Don Mates, our artist guest of honor. And I want to thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Well, Don, one thing I've noticed in looking at your artwork, you seem to have a lot of pirates and in your artwork. And, of course, some of the other con committee wanted to celebrate that fact. And so what do you think of all these pirates running around our convention today?
Oh, it's fun. People are enjoying the pirate phenomenon that's been happening recently. I've gotten involved in them for a long time. When I was in art school growing up in Connecticut, there were some pirate artists that I was exposed to in art school and just before. And some of those were Howard Pyle and N.C. Wyeth from the Brandywine School. And these guys were, my heroes back then. I mean, what they were doing was just phenomenal.
Well, I know you have a lot of pirate artwork on your website, and you're getting ready to come up. Well, you have a pirate calendar out for 2007. So what I'm getting ready to lead into here is, of course, Captain Morgan Rum. So I guess the pirate artwork is what led you into being able to do the Captain Morgan Rum, or how did that come about?
That was kind of a unique opportunity in that I was doing book covers in New York, and I decided by having the dean of my art school said, what you really want to do is get yourself an agent in New York City, and you could stay wherever you are and just do the painting, and he would worry about selling your work. So I took his advice and got an agent in New York, and one of the assignments he put my name in the hat for was a new product being released by Joseph Seagram's and Sons. And they looked at the artwork I did, and I didn't really have any pirate art in my portfolio, but the artwork had an adventuresome, romantic N.C. Wyeth kind of look to some of them, and they decided that it was worth having me pursue this. And I might add that at the time, a lot of different liquor products were being introduced into the marketplace, and most of them were failing. And liquor companies continue to test products and see if the public is going to demand them. And when I did this assignment, I did some color sketches, and I brought them into New York to a big board of directors, and they all sat around and decided if this was a direction they wanted to go, and they thought it was, and they had picked, one from a costume from one sketch, a pose from another, and the face from a third, and mixed it all up. And I did the original line drawing for the rum label and a painting for the rum product, and that was in 1982. And since then, I've done several advertising campaigns, and I have done another, how do I explain this? It's several advertising campaigns for several different advertising agencies. Joseph Seagram's was the client, but I worked through an ad agency. Uh-huh. And most recently, Diageo bought the interest of Captain Morgan from Joseph Seagram's and Sons. And for some reason, I know not why, they've decided to change the rum label. And so my artwork is no longer on the actual rum label. Oh. It's based on my artwork. And some of the advertising and some of the art is still mine, but for some reason, a new broom sweeps clean, so they decided to change the look of the actual captain on the rum bottles.
Well, that's too bad. But I guess you've had a good run with that, haven't you?
Well, 20 years of Captain Morganing, you know. one of the things about the pirate experience I could add was after I did the Captain Morgan illustration, I realized that I was selling a product, and the Henry Morgan character. I mean, most people in the advertising agency didn't really realize that Henry Morgan was an actual person. They just thought it was the guy the rum was named after, and he was a fictional character or something. And so when I originally did the product, I tried to make it look as historically accurate as possible. And again, my friend there, Howard Pyle, had done some renderings of Henry Morgan sacking Panama, and they were, you know, some beautiful illustrations. And I, after I did the rum label and everybody was happy, I wasn't happy with myself because I knew this was not an historically accurate rendition of what Henry Morgan would have looked like. And that made me thinking that, you know, maybe I should do more historically accurate renditions of pirates. You know, I was very much enamored by N.C. Wyeth doing Treasure Island and Howard Pyle's Book of Pirates, and the idea that there isn't a lot of artists doing pirates of that era or that interpretation, and I thought it was something that I would do. So I, whenever I had time in my schedule, I would add a pirate painting here and there. And I moved from Connecticut to Florida, which is a haven for pirates. Uh-huh. And I'm not far from Tampa, which is, you know, has actual pirate holidays and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And
right.
I occasionally go to Key West, which is literally in the Caribbean. And so those opportunities give me an experience to do some pirate things that other artists haven't been able to do. So I've been sort of doing it as a hobby. And the hobby has kind of come to roost by virtue of having calendars coming out and various licensed products and so forth.
Yeah. I was much more familiar with your fantasy and your science fiction work, and it's like, oh, there's, you know, because everyone was talking about the pirate stuff, so I thought I'd want to ask you a little about that. Now, one of the things I just became aware of, I'd seen the advertisements for it, and you're wearing a T-shirt as well, and then you did some of the conceptual artwork for the Ant Bully, which is coming out this weekend, and hopefully by the time this podcast is posted, I will have seen it and everyone else.
It's a really wonderful movie. It's actually the second time I've worked as a concept artist on a motion picture, and it's the same director that I worked both times, and the director actually produced Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius, and I did concept art for that. And I might mention that Bob Eggleton, another Hugo Award-winning artist, has done concept art for those two films as well. And Fred Gambino, an artist who lives in England who has done a lot of science fiction art, has done not only concept art but actual production art and matte painting for that film, and work on Jimmy Neutron as well.
When you were doing the concept art, was it normal illustration on material on regular media, or was this done digitally?
Both. Some artists work digitally. Bob Eggleton, for example, did a lot of beautiful full color pastel drawings on a relatively small scale. And John Davis, the director of film, was taking his original artwork and showing it to Tom Hanks, who owns Playtone, and from there went to Warner. And these were, you know, helping the film, you know, get financing and get the look of its scene. And I was doing pencil drawings, and I was coloring them using watercolor. I did some oil paintings, and then I was doing some translating of the artwork from pencil into color by virtue of computer imaging. And what I did was I worked twice on the film as a concept artist, and then I was asked by, actually, Fred Gambino suggested that they call me and see if I would be available to do some production art as well. And if you're people are interested, I can go into a little bit of what I saw of the process, which was kind of fun. We sat down and listened to the script by the director, and there was a table full of artists, maybe 12, 15 artists, all sketching while we were listening to what the script was about, and he was pretty much directing us, telling us that he really wanted to force perspectives and have the ant world dynamically different visually than the human world so that he can really push these contrasts, and he was very much wanting to deal with this forced perspective angle. So we were very much back to the drawing board every time we didn't have the perspective pushed as much as possible. And we all worked at DNA Studios in Texas for a few days, and then we all went home and submitted artwork by virtue of scanning it and putting it in on a computer. And when we went to their website, the director looked over all the artwork that was being sent in, and he sort of graded it or marked it as how much he liked it. So we were all looking at each other's artwork by virtue of the internet as we were doing concept art in the film. And this went through another stage. And then I did the production art. And what the production art did was took the art. What they did was they took the artwork that we did conceptually and put it into something called an animatic or a black and white rendition of the sequential information going on in the film. And that was sort of a visual storyboard done to videotape. And as I went into production, we took that animatic and made it as if it were a full color, fully rendered still in the motion picture.
Okay.
And then from there it went to digital.
Well, excellent. I wanted to ask you a question. Did you say the word forced perspective or forced?
It's a forced perspective. You're ant bully. You're definitely dealing with, you know, a bully and some ants. So you really want the bully to come across really big and dramatic, and the ants very small. And so the and also there's a size change, shrinking thing happening. And so the perspective really needs to do that. And the point being is that the film is being released in IMAX theaters in 3D.
Okay.
And this is the first film that I've seen an animated film that knew that was forcing perspective, and now that it's in IMAX theaters in 3D, that perspective is actually from the ground up built in. So when you see something happening in the film wearing the 3D glasses, it is much more effective than the add-ons that a lot of motion pictures do to make the 3D look.
Well, my understanding, I now understand what you mean by forced perspective in this. There are two movies that I'm very familiar with where they used used the word in a different way. Darby O'Gill and the Little People, where they actually did the camera work to make the little people. They had one guy far away, but they built the size over, you know, the set oversized, and then they had the other actor up close. And of course, you know, you only have one eye, so it's not in, and so you get the impression that that really is a little person. And then, of course, also Lord of the Rings, the trilogy, also used forced perspective as well. Now, is this the same thing, or is this a little different?
Well, this is different because you're not having to do the same kind of camera tricks. You're doing it with the artist's hand, so to speak. You know, I mean, when we forced a perspective with a computer, there's a few keystrokes that you do in Photoshop that make things bigger and smaller, and we were using that. And but what the director was really wanting to do was having this size contrast work in our favor. And also there's a lot of hyper-realistic rendering being done. You're at an ant level. And so the things that you're seeing in detail are things that you normally don't see in detail at that level. And so what's happening is you're really getting the viewpoint of an ant's eye view. And the thing, and it's just a whole different perspective. You know, what is it like to be on a carpet, you know, and you're ant-sized and having all the fibers coming at you, you know? I mean, it's a whole different idea than, than 3D films where, you know, they add an overlay to an existing image and have it, you know, forced at you, coming at you. And this was done right in the film to begin with.
Well, that's pretty cool. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that. They said when I was told about the movie, I thought maybe it might have been some obscure art house movie. No, it's a major motion picture.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I'm really excited about this because the company DNA Studios is not Hollywood based. And the director actually I received a fax from mm-hmm. him. He saw some artwork in a publication that I had done, and he said, "Well, we're doing this movie called Jimmy Neutron, and we're wondering if you're interested in doing some concept art for it." And I knew nothing about him, knew nothing of it. And he said, "We'll send you a video of what we have so far, and we want to make it a feature length film." And when I looked at it, I was really blown away at how three dimensional and how it was not Bart Simpson with just a moving mouth or anything mm-hmm. like this. It was fully rendered, three dimensional light sources, and it was you could tell that the guy really was into what he was doing in a big way. And I was just excited to do that, and I didn't know that Bob Eggleton had seen the same thing, and you know, we ended up in Texas together, and we've been long friends. And the same with Fred Gambino. He ended up he was a referral that I had made inadvertently to John Davis, and he liked his artwork and had him come in all the way from England. What's different about this is that most Hollywood motion pictures have staff artists or artists that they work with on a normal basis, and they hire them to look at art books and things like this and be influenced by artists that, you know, you see at science fiction mm-hmm. conventions. And the radical change with this DNA Productions is he saw the artwork being done at science fiction conventions and said, "I don't want that artwork in my film. I want the mind that created that artwork in the film." And it's much more ethically sound and honest to have someone who creates, you know, a particular image create another image like that for a film than have someone who is being literally copying another artist's work to put into a film.
Well, hopefully this next question isn't too odd, but those who are familiar with Bob Eggleton's work, those who are familiar with Don Mates' work, with your work, and even Fred Gambino's, would they be able to, if they're very familiar with him, if you're a fan of all of those artists, would you be able to discern, it's like, I wonder if he designed that particular element, or is it more, do they more blend it in altogether?
No, it everyone's work got overlaid by many, many artists. And what happened was we all had an influence on the film. Mm-hmm. And when you have that many artists and everyone working over and in and out of different software programs, what ends up happening is everyone sort of, it becomes a soup, you know, and we're all part of the gravy. And there may be some chunks that sort of look like this and look like that. You know, Bob Eggleton and Fred Gambino did a lot of work on, for example, the wasps in the film.
Okay.
And their influence is heavier in the wasp, but there were a couple other guys that did a lot of dramatic things to the wasp that made them look like what they look like on the film. And so the dynamics of the wasps were designed by the concept artists. The superficial look of the wasps were the animators and later production artists. So it really is a multiple overlay situation. You are part of a team, which is very odd for people who are used to being the sole creators, you know?
Yeah. Hopefully when the DVD comes out, they'll have the concept art illustrations available for people to look at so they can see where they started and where they ended up.
What was really nice was I heard from Bob, who went to the San Diego Comic-Con, and the director, John Davis, was there. And at San Diego Comic-Con, it's a big multimedia event. I think they had 120,000 people there this time. It was huge. And usually they have, you know, the name actors come out on stage to promote the films. Mm-hmm. Well, this time, for one reason or another, the actors didn't really show up, but what they had were the concept artists and production artists on stage with the director. And the director was really nice to say, you know, "All I did was write this, but, you know, when you're looking at the film, you're seeing the work of these people right here. They brought the film to life for me. All I did was put down some words. They made the film." And it was really nice for the director to honor, you know, the concept people involved in a film, because there is a lot of the way things look is very much dependent upon the guy who has a pencil in his hand. And that hasn't changed in any media of illustration.
Well, thank you. One of the last questions I would like to ask you about is that I want to thank you. We appreciate that both you and Jenny did the portfolio reviews. Or is that getting ready to happen tomorrow? Or have you already done
that? Oh, we've done that.
Okay.
I'd like to do a hideous plug or a
selfless do.
Pub. I have this 2007 Pirates calendar that you mentioned. And I'm really happy about this because it's artwork that I've done for myself mostly. And so what you're getting is some things that are coming from me as opposed to done for a publisher for an author's work that's been directed by an editor or a salesperson or something. So, you know, it's nice to have my name on something that, you know, was self-generated, which is really nice for artists to do.
Well, and I did see it in the dealer's room there, so I'll probably have to go pick up a copy. But I know that they can find out more information about the calendar if they go to your website,
yes.
DonMaitz, DonMaitz.com.
No, someone else has the .com. I have the .org and the .net.
.net, okay.
But the actual site is run from a good friend of Janny and mine, and he's just done some amazing work on this thing. And it's set up in actually the web. When you do DonMaitz.org or DonMaitz.net, you will come to a site called Paravia.com, and it's a continent in Janny's world. And if you go Paravia.com/DonMaitz, you get to my site, and /JannyWertz, you get to Janny's site.
Well, I've gone to the main page, and it's spelled Paravia.com.
Great.
And then, of course, there's links to both of you.
Yes.
And, you know, you can go either look at Don's stuff or look at Janny's stuff.
Yes.
Well, Don, I've enjoyed this, and I appreciate you allowing me to interview you. And hopefully you'll enjoy, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the convention and that you've enjoyed Oklahoma so far.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me here.
You're welcome. I think you'll agree that both Don and Janny are a fascinating and talented couple. I really appreciate the time they took out of the convention to allow me to interview them. As a reminder, their website again is paravia.com, where you can go for more information about their works, past, present, and future. So thanks for listening until our next Conestoga podcast. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org, or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcast@sftulsa.org. Please send us an email or put a comment on the website and let us know what you thought of this podcast.